I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hi, everyone. My name is Ronnie Scott. I'm a novelist and I teach creative writing at RMIT. And this is Masculinity on the Ropes. But before I introduce the session itself and we meet our guests, I'd first like to pay respects to the Wurundjeri Willin people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional owners of the land where I'm speaking from today, and to acknowledge as well that you and our panelists may be coming from lands with their own traditional owners. Our panelists certainly are, and you likely are. So we pay respects to elders past and present. In this session, we're going to hear from three writers of nonfiction in a discussion about men's complicated relationship with stoicism, love, and empathy, and its role in grief, trauma, and redemption. This is Masculinity on the Ropes with Melbourne Writers Festival. Rick Morton is the senior reporter at the Saturday Paper, where he covers social policy, national affairs, and science. His debut memoir, 100 Years of Dirt, became a national bestseller, and My Year of Living Vulnerably charts the rediscovery of love after a trauma diagnosis, his hard-won healing from childhood neglect and complex PTSD. It's a wonderful memoir. Hi, Rick.
Hey, Ronnie. Thanks so much for having me.
No worries. Thanks for being here. Lek Blaine is a writer from country Queensland. Lek's work has been published in Best Australian Essays, Kill Your Darlings, The Griffith Review, The Guardian, and The Monthly, and he's the author of the latest quarterly essay about class and masculinity. His first book, a memoir, Car Crash, examines Australia's larrikin brand of toxic masculinity and how to recover from catastrophe when you've been taught to stare down heartbreak. It's also a wonderful book. Hi, Lek.
Hey, Ronnie. Great to be here.
And Matthew Seeney is an essayist, playwright, and fiction writer. Matthew has been published in Mianjin, The Age, Overland Journal, ARIO Magazine, Crikey, and the ABC. His work engages with themes of class, masculinity, sexuality, and the social impact of the internet. He co-hosts Getting Lit, a literature podcast, and is currently finishing a novel. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Ronnie. Great to be here.
Lovely to have you all. So, Rick, I wondered if we could start with you and your memoir, My Year of Living Vulnerably. It covers so much territory. It's this kind of nested book of different essays, different topics, and it's part reported, it's part remembered. It's all brilliant, and a lot of it is about masculinity, but that's not all it's about. I wonder if you could talk a bit about how masculinity is approached in the context of this book, and really just what the book's about.
Yeah, thanks, Ronnie. Look, that's really lovely of you to say. It was kind of a bit of a passion project for me because I was diagnosed with complex post-traumatic stress disorder after my first book came out. And even though everyone calls this a memoir, it's really kind of this constellation of kind of what I like to think of science reporting, a bit of philosophy, a bit of memoir, and a bit of journalism. The cause of, I guess, of my trauma diagnosis was this really distinct, acute lack of love in my early childhood, particularly from my father. When I was alone on this cattle station, my brother was fighting for his life, you know, 1,200 kilometres away in hospital with the rest of my family. And then witnessing him have this affair with the governess, and he was 19, I should add. And kind of looking at, from him onwards, the men in my life in country Queensland and then regional Queensland, this idea that to cope with suffering, we must be stoic or strong and unbending. And I guess part of this book emerged from my response to that, which was I saw a lot of men kind of diminished through that approach, including myself, particularly myself, because I was trying to mimic, and that was that caused me nothing but distress and hurt in the end.
So it sounds as though masculinity was something that led you to your thinking in the memoir, and maybe, oh, sorry, I shouldn't call it a memoir, you know, the book of essays that is also about your life.
You're allowed to call it whatever you want.
Thanks. But the idea of masculinity and its specific kind of characteristics and qualities and troubles led to your thinking and to the way that you were writing this book?
I think what I did was I imbibed the atmosphere that I grew up in. I don't think it's the same everywhere, but I think, and Lek might be able to add to this, but particularly where I was and the people I moved around, there was this ideal of a man, and they were very tough and unyielding. They kind of matched the environment, particularly in outback Queensland, where you had to be harsh to survive. And I think whether I knew it or not at the time, what I was doing was practicing an act of dealing with pain and hurt in my life. And that act was based on what other men around me did. And I thought that they didn't cry, and I thought that they didn't express their emotion. Now, of course, they did in ways that were not familiar to me, such as going to, like, you know, sporting matches, or in my dad's case, playing polo lacrosse and, you know, hanging around with your mates. But I didn't understand those things, and I certainly didn't feel like I fit into that world. And so a lot of my performance in my 20s, when I shut myself off from the world and refused to hug my friends or tell them I love them, was me doing what I thought was what men should do.
Right. And so I think that that is definitely something that comes up again and again in Car Crash, in Lex's memoir. This idea that masculinity is something that can characterize people, it can also be observed, it can also be misunderstood, and it is also maybe something that controls how people react to different situations, something that people can sort of engage with more or less successfully and have very kind of strange ideas about, maybe particularly when people are growing up. Lek, I wonder if you could tell us about the memoir and about how masculinity plays into it.
The memoir is about a car accident that I was in when I was 17 that killed three of my friends and the aftermath of that, but then it also reroutes to the before and my upbringing in regional Queensland. And certainly, like, yeah, I totally relate to Rick's story. And there was, I guess the main difference for me would have been that we weren't in anywhere near as a harsh of environment as what Rick was in, but and certainly my family, like I knew a lot of farming families, but my family were, my dad was a publican. So the main arena for masculinity wasn't actually against the physical environment or the land or anything like that. It was mainly through sport. And that was it was mainly versus other humans or other men. And that was, yeah, something that when I was growing up, I had lots of older brothers and lots of cousins, and they're my first memories of being a child or of watching sport. And that was certainly, it was like a religion for me. And so which produced a very intense sort of identity crisis, because I was just like preternaturally bad at sport and at athletics, and so it really, I had to work out a way to express myself in these arenas that without the main sort of the main form available to all these other people, I didn't really have that available, because I just couldn't quite cut it. So that meant that I sort of overcompensated with a persona that I drew from all of these people around me, and I really tried to amplify it to the point where I was probably more of a larrikin than, say, my brothers, who were good at sport but didn't sort of need to overcompensate. And so that meant that I, especially by the time that I was a teenager, like I immersed myself in binge drinking and risk-taking behavior probably a lot younger than what they had. And that was sort of the precursor to me being in this accident when I was 17, but then also my incapacity to express my emotions afterwards. And so that sort of, I follow that process of not being able to grieve and then bottling all of that up and then eventually sort of suffering a bit of a breakdown, and the way that I sort of put myself back together and learned how to express my emotions both or to be comfortable with my emotions, both with myself, but especially like to express my emotions to someone like my dad, who I sort of saw as a template of masculinity and of toughness.
Right. I mean, both of your memoirs draw these really interesting links between expression and vulnerability and masculinity and the ways in which those things play off each other. And the first thing I think of when I think of your book, Lek, is there's a memorial scene where you are tasked with speaking about one of your friends in the car crash, and you paint this kind of picture for us, the reader now, of your persona then as someone who, kind of in the way that you're speaking about your friend, but also the way you're performing yourself, is very sort of bright and cheery and sort of focused on the fun of life, and surface level is maybe how you describe it. And I think that it's so vivid and striking, the way that you sort of presented yourself in that scene, and also the way that you unpacked it in the book. I wonder how it is that you came to the sense of vulnerability that you present in the memoir itself.
This is the thing about like the larrikin persona. It wasn't a stoicism in terms of being like short on words or anything like that. Like, I was an extremely chatty person. A lot of the people who I was trying to emulate were quite over the top sort of personalities and who would express themselves quite willingly, but it was just in a way that totally excluded any negative emotions or vulnerability or compassion. And so it wasn't so much that I needed to discover that, because the great contradiction was that I was an extremely like emotional, vulnerable child, and so I didn't need to like create a mode of expression so much as like strip back away all the artifice that I'd built up since I'd started. I went to a Catholic boys' school in grade 5, and I do remember like a conscious thing at this school where I'd always been such like a sook and like so quick to cry, and I had to, that just wasn't going to cut it at this school. And so I remember, and it, what didn't happen immediately, but over the first few years there, and by the time I got to high school, I was like, I'd gone from being someone who could cry quite easily to being someone who was like incapable of crying, and to the point where I, yeah, went through, this was later obviously, but went through those three funerals and all of those quite traumatic events, just being completely incapable of crying. With something like therapy, it wasn't, as I said, it wasn't so much about finding some new form of masculinity to emulate so much as it was about just like reconnecting with this person who had always been there, but who had put up so many walls against both expressing emotion, but also feeling emotion. Like that was, I think it was, and the main way I did that was just through conversation with someone like my dad, who once I actually expressed some of my own emotions to him, it became like uncannily clear how similar we both were in ways, and how the experiences that he'd been through, which had always been painted to me as quite sort of like jokily, like with dark humor, that he'd actually been through some serious grief and serious trauma. And once he was able to express that to me, and once I was able to express some of my experiences to him, it stripped away the main wall, because I mean, like he was the main person that I was trying to emulate, and he was the main person that I was trying to impress in terms of my approach to emotions.
So I guess it's not as simple as sort of a false masculine persona or an unemotional masculinity and sort of a something vulnerable underneath. It's more like there's a relationship between the way that masculinity forms a person, the way that it's spoken or performed, and the kinds of feelings that are possible in different styles of being. And that makes me think of your wonderful essay, Matt, Where Did Camp Go?, which is published in Overland. And I think that you published it on the occasion of that Met Gala, where many celebrities kind of famously misconstrued camp. And that's, I mean, at first glance, the idea of camp and the idea of masculinity would almost be in opposition to each other. But I wonder if it's more complicated than that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So when we talk about masculinity, I know that people like to do the trendy thing of pluralizing it. So there are masculinities, so different ways of being masculine, I guess. And I think camp sort of falls into that because it's a very masculine style of performance or appreciation of performance, but pretty much only gay men are sort of, they're sort of the masters of it, right? Like traditionally. And it's a sort of masculine form of communication in a particular, a kind of male kind of subculture. And for those who don't know, camp is like the, you know, Judy Garland worshipping kind of stereotypical enjoyment of artificiality and, you know, these sort of heightened styles. And yeah, I did write that in response to the Met Gala. I think it was in 2019, which seems so long ago now. And this idea of that you had lots of people, lots of celebrities who didn't quite get it, because it is a very kind of subculturally, traditionally gay, masculine form of communication. And I think part of the disconnect there was not appreciating those sort of, I guess, undercurrent of the way that it worked. And so I think it's interesting to link this sort of style of performance with something like Stoicism, where in a way, this kind of stereotypical idea of Stoicism as a kind of, I don't know, suppression of emotion. It's almost the inverse of that. Like it's the reason why Judy Garland, for instance, is a sort of camp icon is her heightened emotional resonance. Like she gives it her all in her performances, and gay men just can't get enough of that. So it's like the inverse of that, and appreciating, it's not so much emotionally expressing yourself, but appreciating emotion in a kind of ironic, almost arch way.
Yeah, it's, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about all three of these works together is that they all approach masculinity as something that must be understood, or masculinities, as you say, Matt, as a set of things that must be understood. And that's, you know, that's a topic that all three of you as narrators approach in different ways. And I wonder what it is about masculinity or masculinities that is difficult to understand. Why is that a worthy and necessary enterprise? What's the obstacle, Matt?
There is a bit of an issue with men's place in the world these days for a variety of reasons, but we are I think the question of emotion that I was talking about just before is relevant to that, because we live in a world now highly mediated through social media, I think, which social media encourages us to sort of emotionally express in a weird way, in not in a kind of in the way traditional way. It's like you're liking things, you're sharing things, you're telling us what's on your mind, as it says on Facebook and stuff. And so it's almost like the emotional landscape has been mediatized in a really interesting way that I think has warped a lot of people's perceptions of themselves, but also in particular men's, because I think it's not quite conducive to the way that the men have traditionally communicated, I guess. So it's sort of like a disconnect there between the technology and the emotional resonance.
That's interesting. And in both of the memoirs as well, there are these kind of these moments of cataloging media and signs of masculinity, which are, you know, in some ways simpatico with what the narrators are going through, Rick and Lek, and in some ways at odds with them. Rick, I remember there's a catalog in your masculinity essay of different ways that products that may traditionally be difficult to market to men have been marketed to men. Yeah. And I wonder what your favorites were.
I mean, the whole, it's such a dispiriting kind of catalog, isn't it, when you go through it? It's like, you know, there's bath bombs for men that are in the shape of hand grenades, and it's like, you know, in case you need to bathe but feel like a man about it, which is always me, because I struggle with that most. Matt, I want to read that essay on Kent so bad now, because I have opinions. But, you know, there's I'm trying to think of all the other ones, like, because they do the inverse as well. Of course, there were batteries that were pink for women, as in case, you know, the women needed to recharge some appliances but weren't sure if they were welcome. And it's such a strange, you see them everywhere you go, right? There's certain types of kind of, there's wine in a can for men. And I can't remember the tagline, but it's so silly because it's like, you know, we don't care about fruity notes. We're just here to drink. And it's something aggressive like that. Now, I find it offensive from my point of view, not like actually literally offensive, but I just find it odd, right? Because most men I know don't want these things. They're as embarrassed by it as I am. And I'm talking about straight men, gay men, queer men, whatever. Who is the marketing coming from? Why is this there? There is a rump of people out there who kind of fall for this stuff. And certainly I've noticed it in kind of crossing the world that I left behind from, you know, regional Queensland, growing up in poverty, surrounded by working class people. There is an insecurity there, I think, which is a lot of what you find when you kind of trawling through social media. It's like that great example, which is a meme that anyone who's been on social media would have seen by now, but it's this Snapchat picture of a rainbow. And this poor guy called Kevin says, "Is it gay to like rainbows? Or is it gay to say this is beautiful?" And it's like, no, Kevin, it's not. It's just part of the breadth of human existence, man. You'll be okay. But I guess when you were talking to Matt before about, you know, who caused, like, what is the problem we're trying to understand here, or what is it about masculinity that we need to know? We need to know why it is so often the case that men are our own worst enemies. It's this idea that not only are women and people from minority communities the vast kind of majority of people who are affected by straight men in particular in this world, in terms of sexual assault or aggression or gaslighting or emotional abuse, but also gay men, because we are, myself included, I held myself to this ideal of the straight heteronormative guy that for so long, like doing that for so long, caused me to excise the part of myself that was gay. And I was quite disgusted by it, and I didn't want any part of that. And like, that hurt me. And then the inverse of that is also true, in the sense that the ideal that to be seen as feminine, whether you're a woman or gay or whatever, is so injurious to the archetype of the man that they actually enforce that hierarchy amongst themselves by saying, you've got to be strong, or you've got to, you know, win in this fight. And they hurt themselves in doing so. So we really are at every turn our own worst enemy.
I would say, though, that I would love a grenade bath bomb because, like, it's a bath bomb, so it should be shaped like a bomb.
I guess it depends on what the contents are, isn't it? Whether it's like notes of peppercorn,
yes,
and musk.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Thank you for pointing out that it's an internally cohesive object. I think that's a really good point. You know, there's a point in your essay, Matt, where you say, it's a John Waters quote, to understand bad taste, you have to have good taste, which is, you know, and I think that there's a way in which by kind of unpacking something like a bath bomb shaped like a hand grenade, not to make that the topic of the entire podcast.
Which is very camp, by the way, but...
How is it camp?
It's camp because it's so over the top. Like, it's like ridiculous. It's especially if it goes the extra mile to make it. This is the thing as well. People often associate camp with femininity, but like there can be very kind of traditionally masculine forms of camp. Like, so when something is really kind of over the top, trying to be macho, sort of thing. So if it's like a blue grenade, or even if it's kind of green, like the classic kind of World War II grenades or something, that'd probably be a bit camp to me, I think, because of the artificiality, you know.
Like, it reminds me of the scene in your memoir, Car Crash, where you go to Rumours, and you describe Rumours as a nightclub for horny speed freaks in the 1980s and 1990s. And that's where one of your catalogue of possibly camp, possibly masculine items, possibly kind of time-based as well, items appears. You write, bashful Catholic schoolboys with bulging Adam's apples had wasted money on colognes, tuxedos, and ambitious stockpiles of contraception, only to learn that they were still the same tongue-tied young men. I wonder if this is there anything that you would kind of rescue from these memories and from this time and this place? Because I guess what earlier on you were talking about how masculinity wasn't necessarily something for you to get away from, in your, you know, the story of your, I guess your character in this memoir, and also of course your life. It was something for you to understand and to approach differently.
Yeah, well, and it's fascinating just picking up from the rest of the conversation that, like, I grew up in this hyper-masculine environment, and especially at a Catholic boys' school, the most hyper-masculine group of people are the rugby league players. But they are also the campus group of people in that environment as well, without knowing it. Like, the only place... The people flying closest to the flame in that environment aren't the drama kids or the theatre kids who are getting called... you know, faggots or whatever. It's the rugby league players who know, like, intimately the size of each other's penises, like, and like are constantly talking about it, constantly showing each other their penises, constantly, you know, watching porn with each other.
You're so right, like, because like that did not happen at my school.
Yeah, and so there's both this. There is like a really deep homoeroticism, I think, in Australian masculinity, that like people have talked about, like, that a lot of these people that we're trying to emulate were in really harsh environments, and a lot of the time it was just men in these environments, or whether it was later at wars or in these football clubs. And so it's sort of like the unspoken thing about, like, a lot of these environments is that the people who are most stringent about the standards of masculinity are also repressing, like, quite strong sort of homoerotic feelings and tendencies. And yeah, that was, I think, definitely the case, like, at high school. And yeah, that was the thing about in terms of rescuing masculinity, like, in terms of me emulating someone like my dad, it wasn't, I didn't want to, like, lose everything about my dad, because a lot of the things that made him, like, super macho, and like there were positive aspects of that. Like, he was someone who felt like he needed to look after people. He saw himself as a protector, and that was, like, a very literal thing. He became a foster carer, and he looked after people who had been in, like, who had been abused and who were had learning disabilities, and so he took that very literally. There was also lots of negative things, like, and I don't sort of shy away from that in the book, in terms of, like, drink driving, in terms of binge drinking. So in terms of the high school thing, like, that's the contradiction, is that there was also, like, as much as there was, like, a super hyper masculine pissing contest between all these guys at this school, there was also, like, these random expressions of quite, like, emotional openness, and also sort of, like, that real hunger for, like, kinship, which you don't really, is seen as a little bit naff outside of, like, those environments. Like, I don't think that you could, that longing for connection, like, I don't think that you could go around in the, like, as an adult being quite the same way. So yeah, definitely there's not, like, I don't want to, like, totally shun the whole of high school from my life, or the whole of my adolescence from my life. Like, there was lots of, like, positive connections and positive experiences. And I guess it's just working out which ones are negative and trying not to like repeat those negative characteristics and like inflicting them on the people around you. And so that's sort of like a constant and inflicting them on yourself. And so that's been like a constant battle. And that's not something that I ever, even after like a decade of therapy, that's not something that I've ever like drew a line under. Like that's just an ongoing sort of thing.
Right. I guess it can be such a temptation to view, you know, a set of codes that make up a gender identity in terms that are positive or negative, and to think that masculinity is good or masculinity is bad when you set out to discuss it. But I mean, Matt, in your essay on camp, masculinity is neither viewed as, but you know, positive or negative is like sort of the wrong terms in which to understand. They're almost senseless terms in which to understand a set of gender codes. Is that right?
Yeah, a little bit. I've just actually sort of realized as everyone's been talking that I'm pretty sure everyone on this panel grew up in Queensland, which is interesting, but... So, and I did too. So, and it was interesting to hear Lek, you talk about your father because my father, we were an army family. So we ended up in Townsville, which is a big garrison town in North Queensland. I think it has one of the biggest army barracks in Australia. Lots of kind of army there in where I grew up. And my dad was interesting in that I will get to your question, Ronnie. I'm just sort of reflecting. but my dad was interesting in that his form of hypermasculinity was very much ingrained in the army, which I think is very different to what Rick and Lek are talking about, because it's not so much it's based in kind of capability and competence. It's not so much about like showing off to all your mates and shit. So that's a really interesting kind of contrast, I think. And again, getting back to my whole shtick about masculinities. Yeah, my dad wasn't really about like getting pissed with his mates. And so he didn't have many mates because I think the kind of togetherness, being a cohesive unit with someone, was part of his job. So he was a bit like not really about like getting on the beers with his mates and stuff. So I find that very interesting as well, that but he is still very macho. So it's like, it's very interesting that, and I guess this comes back to your question, Ronnie, that there are those different kind of forms, and are we asking the right question there? Like, I don't think I would examine my father's form of masculinity as either negative or positive. I think there's different kinds of men. And that is that's the thing that I think is important in kind of contemporary society, is to sort of realize that there are different kinds of men.
Thank you. When we talk about masculinity, it sounds as though there are some things that we can make sense of by observing them and by trying to understand them, as we've discussed. But it sounds as well that there are some things that are really difficult to exhume, things that are repressed, or things that are sort of unspoken and yet kind of persist in our lives and in our dealings with masculinities. Rick, in your book, was there anything that you had difficulty voicing, you know, to even kind of understand the shape of it?
Yeah, God, everything. I mean, it's so true though, right? Like, it's like we assume that our intuition is enough to help us understand the world, and it's not. You know, time is relative for people moving at different speeds, which is something that only emerged from Einstein's equations, and it's not something we ever thought was actually true based on our observations of how clocks move and all the rest of it. But it's true about our inner workings as well. It's true about our consciousness. In fact, that's one of the great mistakes, I think, that when I was talking to David Chalmers for this book, who's an Australian philosopher now working in New York University, he says that we think our intuition can guide us about, you know, whether we've got free will or any of these things. And it's just not true. And that was the hardest part for me, not just about dealing with the tropes about masculinity, but just in terms of my trying to reconstruct how it is I actually feel about when I'm going through a traumatic episode or re-experiencing the same trauma, but also about, you know, my father, my family, the poverty I grew up in. What is the effect that all of these things have had on my brain and the way I operate now as a human being? And if I do think I understand those things, am I just making up a story to help me feel better about myself? And I'm still struggling with that, to be quite honest, because I am obsessed with being as accurate as I can in terms of the sensations and the feelings and the revelations, I guess. And I've tried to complement it with research from studies as much as I possibly can. But at the end of the day, we are thoroughly misleading, all of us, you know. And I think, you know, somebody, I can't remember who said this, but it's a fairly obvious point, but it still makes you kind of sit back and go, oh, yeah, that's right. It's this idea that, you know, the person you are in your head is the only copy of that person that exists anywhere. Every single one of the 250 people that know you somewhat or somewhat well has a completely different understanding of who they think you are. They might find things annoying that you don't think you even do. And so the moment you realize that, you have to kind of abandon any sense of fidelity or the achievement of kind of proper truth, right? And just go with what makes the most sense at the time. And the thing that helped me the most in understanding all of those things is that the process is the therapy. It's not about getting there or getting cured or being better at observing or understanding the complete truth of the situation. It's the process of inquiry that matters, I think. And to me, that's what this book was. It was just my little niche Rick Morton book where I got to talk about all of these things that helped me understand the world I live in.
Lek, this might be my last question for you, and it's really the same question. Do you feel that there is still kind of a mystery at the heart of what you were writing about in your book? Is the process incomplete? Is the process the point of it? Or is it about discovering something about yourself and about masculinities?
Yeah, it's definitely those things. But yeah, there is a mystery, because I'd separate the book from who I am. I didn't set out to record any like objective truth, because one of the things about writing the book is that once you actually start trawling back through all these other people's experiences, and especially when you've got things like police reports that you can go through and court reports, and you see how like malleable people's memories are, and like how incomplete and mysterious memory and just experience is. And so I still don't really feel at peace having written the book with all the things that I write about in the book, especially the stuff about identity. Like I don't have, like as I said before, that's just an ongoing thing. I don't think anyone ever makes complete peace with themselves. You know, that can be like a terrifying thing, but that can also be like Rick's saying, in terms of like the it's also part of the whole journey. And I don't think that, like, I don't think if anyone was ever at complete peace with themselves, they'd ever, like, you know, there would be a need to be creative, or there would be a need to write or to make art or to have these conversations. Like, there'd be a pretty boring world. The other side of that is that it produces complete chaos and emotional longing and emotional hurt. But that's sort of, yeah, that's just like that's the ball game of life.
And Matt, I think this will be my last question for you and the last question of the session, but it's the same question again. It's, you know, if you take it as a given that you're not writing in order to complete something or to attain a complete understanding of something, what is the horizon? And I saw you nodding during Lek's response then. What is the horizon that you're writing towards?
I guess I'm obviously only speaking for myself, but I'm not definitely in a sort of not writing to understand. I'm more writing towards a thought, like I'm developing a thought via writing. So, and maybe the ultimate goal of that is some kind of understanding, but it's sort of not the intent, I guess. I kind of work out what I think about something by writing about it or on it or through it. And so that shapes my approach, I guess. And yeah. Masculinity and particular thing, different kinds of aesthetics and styles, and the way that class plays into that is all comes through. That's how I get there. It's through the writing that I work out what I think, rather than try to understand something. I don't know if that's a distinction without a difference, but that's the way I look at it.
Thank you all so much for talking about masculinity and its being on the ropes with me, and thank you all for listening. If you would like to buy copies of journals in which Matt's essays are published, if you want to buy Rick's and Lek's books, the Festival Bookshop partner is Readings, and you can access it online, readings.com.au.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.